Law is Cool, episode number 11.
Taking up the song in a strange land, so let the words of our mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight. Override.
I'm Jacob Kaufman. I'm going into second year law at the University of Western Ontario.
And my name is Omar Haredi. I'm a second year law student as well at the University of Western Ontario.
So that opening music was a little different today.
It is. We have an intro there from an American, former of the American Army. He's now living in London, Ontario. And we met at a rally for war resistors here in London. And we'll be doing an interview with him later on.
What other interviews do we have?
We also have an interview with Ari Kaplan, who's the author of The Opportunity Maker, Strategies for Inspiring Your Legal Career, which is really a very inspiring interview, which I think our listeners will enjoy.
Very interesting. Now, before we get to that, we were talking about The Dark Knight.
That's right, we were. Apparently you saw this recently?
I saw it. I'm seeing it again tonight with one of my friends.
You're going to see it twice.
I'm going to see it in IMAX, so that's how I can justify, you know, seeing it.
The double expense. You're a very good customer then.
Yeah, well, a lot, they're saying this is possibly the movie, if any movie's going to do it, that'll unseat Titanic.
Really?
Yeah, so, well, because it's got this great confluence between great critical reception and people liking superhero movies.
Not everybody is as enthusiastic about the movie.
It's true.
There are some criticisms out there as well that it might be promoting vigilantism and other kinds of controversial political policies. Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting article by Spencer Ackerman of the Washington Independent, and his thesis was Batman is how Dick Cheney sees himself. Like, this is, it's not so much this is what the Bush administration is, but this is what the Bush administration do. Like, throughout the movie, and I don't want to spoil anything, but Batman does things like extraordinary rendition, torture of suspects, you know, going beyond the law to save the world. And that's the Bush administration's thesis.
So Dick Cheney is the Dark Knight.
That Dick Cheney is the Dark Knight. On the other hand, the Cognomanus blog posted an interesting article where he argued that, in fact, Batman, the underlying thesis is that it is a critique of the Bush
policies.
View, and that the Joker is blowback. That in the first movie, it's because Batman is doing the things that has created the Joker, and that the Joker has come. So his argument is, in fact, well, Batman, he agrees that Batman has betrayed the Bush administration and how they see themselves, but he says that the movie as a whole in the context shows that that particular viewpoint is not, in fact, good for the city.
Interesting.
Yeah. And Matt Iglesias had some other interesting thoughts on, you know, looking at Batman from a leftist perspective. And of course, some people say it's a movie about a guy who dresses up like a bat and beats people up. So.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Yes. But why should Canadian law students care so much about American politics?
Well, what was it Pierre Elliott Trudeau said when, you know, the Americans sneeze, Canada gets a cold? You know, we're very linked with them, and they are
a very
powerful country in the world right now, so we can actually have an interest in what happens south of the border. Now, I understand you met some people today from
the Democrats Abroad Canada. They're trying to encourage Americans who are living in Canada to also vote and be involved in the political process.
Well, Democrats Abroad actually have a place at the political primary. There's an abroad primary, and they get 2.5 delegates to go to the Democratic convention. I don't quite know what happened with the half delegate. I don't really know if I want to know what kind of shenanigans you want to get that. But it's very interesting. I mean, certainly Canadians love Obama. The world loves Obama.
They definitely do.
The world, of course, doesn't get a vote. Now, there's some people saying that the world is going to be disappointed by Obama. And I don't think that has anything to do with Obama. Well, I'm a big fan of Obama.
No.
But I think people just project onto Obama
their own views.
Yeah, they think Obama is the Messiah. He's the Obama-Messiah. He's going to heal the world. I think he's going to be a good president. We actually had a post on our site about some who flip-flops Obama and changed him. Uh-huh. I don't quite buy the allegations this shows Obama would have voted for the Iraq War. Obama uh-huh. was a very passionate critique of the Iraq War uh-huh. from the start. And more importantly, Obama's critique of the Iraq War was not necessarily one of this is a bad thing. It was this is a stupid thing.
Yeah.
They say Obama's flip-flopped on this FISA wireless uh-huh. war attack uh-huh. where the government can tap certain people's communications without authorizing them. And they're saying, well, why would Obama support this? And maybe Obama is pretty sure he's going to be president and wouldn't mind having the power to do that. Yep. On the other hand, I don't think Obama wants to be trapped in Iraq. So exactly. Obama's a smart guy, so I think you can count on Obama. I can state pretty confidently, I don't think Obama would have voted for the Iraq War.
Probably not. A lot of Americans also didn't agree with the American War, including some of those in the armed forces. And
yeah, I believe we have an interview with one of them now.
Exactly, and that's been one of the issues in Canadian politics as well, in terms of how do we deal with these war resistors, people who are in the Canadian Army, and they come over to the U.S. And as I was mentioning to Irene Matheson, who's the NDP representative in London, that Canada does have a very long history of providing, I guess you could say, refuge or shelter to the political turmoil south of us, going back to the Underground Railroad, Tecumseh, Joseph Brandt, the Vietnam War, and this recent episode is just a continuation of a very long saga and a legacy that we have here in Canada in terms of having that type of role.
Well, even going back to 1776 with the Tories going
well, there was
up
that
here.
As well, exactly.
let's roll the tape
back
to you.
Okay.
My name is Richard Drew Drosty II. I'm age 22. I've lived in Canada since March 7th.
What brings you to Canada?
It's a long journey and a long and winding road that led me to Canada. I joined the army at the age of 17 for many reasons, mostly to escape the lifestyle I was living, the promise of education, the pursuit of something more grand than what I was living. I was homeless at the time, living in my car for the previous 2 years. I'm still trying to get my own education and just maintain a working lifestyle. They provided me so many benefits and what I now know is half-truths, obviously, but I didn't at the time. And at the age of 17, I was able to make that one decision to give my life for the country that I barely knew anything about, but you're not even old enough to make any other adult decision in the U.S. at that age, right? So I joined as a combat engineer at this time, believing that there was this huge terrorist threat on our nation, believing that America could do no wrong type mentality. You know, I followed CNN and Fox News pretty much my whole life. And, you know, if you don't look for an outside source, you're not going to find it. Yeah. And if you're happy in your bubble, you know, why burst it, right?
Yeah.
So the further I get into the military, I become more educated with what's really going on all across the world, and not just in Iraq or just Afghanistan, but also the human trafficking and prostitution rings around military installations across the world. The fact that we were standing up for human rights and freedom to me, and seeing these things happen in Korea while I was stationed there, was my first big question against the military. And I basically got told to shut up and try not to fix anything that your pay grade can't handle, you know. And they say they don't support it if you ask them, and they'll be quoted and saying they don't support it. But during the day, there's regulations. Only U.S. soldiers and U.S. citizens can go inside these clubs and these bars that contain all this human trafficking and prostitution. All of their money for those rings are coming from soldiers' pockets, you know, so it shows that there may not be verbal support, but there's definite financial support, right? And that was my first big problem. Around my second year in the military, I became a conscientious objector to the war in Iraq because of the illegalities, the unhumane activities that are happening over there, the just unusual behavior, the way we treat men, the way we treat women.
And what does it mean to be a conscientious objector for those of us who don't know?
It's within the military, there's a system, so if you want to be a non-combatant, this is supposed to be a legal thing. You can fill out this conscientious objector packet, which states that you are against the dualities of the war that you know the efforts working for, and then you can work as a non-combatant inside the U.S. military, such as a cook, a medic, a X-ray technician, whatever it may be, right? There's numerous jobs, and they're supposed to supply you with that. Well, around a year after I filled out that paperwork, it was mysteriously lost, and I was told this with a wink from the person I was asking. So it goes to show you that they weren't trying to put that much effort into helping me with this conscientious objector packet. Around my third year, 6 month, which meant I only had about 6 months left on my original contract, I found out I was getting stop-lost and sent to Iraq. Well, this time I've already stated I was an objector and I will have no part in this war. If anything, I would like to end this war. You know what I mean? I'm not going to fight in it. And they said, well, either you go to this war, you go to jail, your only other option is to re-enlist, signing on a new contract, and get a non-combatant job, right? So those are my options. I decide, through friends and people that were looking out for me, honestly, that had no role over what happens to me, they advised me to re-enlist for a different job, and I did. I thought it was a smart thing to do, so I re-enlist to be a computer networker. It's called a systems information operator analyst. It's all computer networking, IP configuration, connecting servers, routers, and such.
What was your reason for choosing that kind of a job?
It was mostly just maintaining networks for the generals and the superiors that are going over there anyways, which I didn't know when I signed up for the job. Yeah. The reason I signed up for the job is because I thought it was a communication job, so we can communicate.
And you probably wouldn't be in the front lines.
Absolutely, by my understanding, I wouldn't be participating in any combatant side of the military. Well, my last week of training, I'm about to graduate this new course, and I find out that I'm going to 4th RTB, which stands for Ranger Training Battalion. So not am I only training combatants, I'm training the elite combatants to go fight in this war, and I told them I wouldn't have any part of it. So there I go to try to fill out another conscious objector packet. It's denied because I don't meet the quote-unquote criteria. I ask them what the criteria is. They can't give me an answer. Then I go to mental health and I explain my reasoning behind all this. They try to put me on sleeping aids and antidepressants, saying I'll get over it. I just need rest and to lighten up. And I was told to suck it up and drive on. And that was their cure-all answer for that. And then I went to a chaplain, which is a preacher or a priest, and he finds your religious denomination. At this time, I was still very much more agnostic, which is I believe in a higher power, but I think there's too much out there for the human mind to comprehend, really. And I'm talking to him, and he tried to explain to me that God justified this war and wouldn't harm us or call us sinners for our wrongdoings to the Iraqi people, civilian and terrorist alike, because a human's a human regardless of their decisions, right? And so that's what he tried to convince me. I talked to him on numerous occasions, and I couldn't get anything out of him or any help. And after I went and talked up and down the chain of command and tried to get this non-combat job, and after so much dedication I put in, I actually went AWOL 4 days after my original ETS date. So I fulfilled my original contract.
Okay.
And I came to Canada.
Now, why Canada? Why not Mexico?
There you go. That's a great question, and that's something that I wish more potential resistors would know, is when I was going through this, I was looking for other instances where soldiers experienced similar grounds or something that happened to me, because I knew it was happening all across the military. And so I looked up online, what better source, right? And I find there's all these soldiers, and there's so many thousands living in the States, and I found that there was anywhere from 200 to 500 living in Canada. I found that there were about 50 that applied for refugee status in Canada, and the things that they were doing, the political aspects, the education, I didn't come here to hide. I came here very well knowing that I could be deported and sentenced in the United States for my wrongdoing, and I'm fine with that. I accept that. I came here to educate the people. I came here to open people's views, and even if they don't understand and even if they don't disagree, at least they're not ignorant to the matter.
So did you seek legal counsel here in Canada then when you came up here?
Yes. If you apply for a refugee claim, one great thing is legal aid covers it for you.
Right.
You don't have to come up with that on your own, and that will supply the finances for your counsel or your lawyer. And I went to Michael Lobach's office. He's known for fighting for war resistors and refugee claimants all from different abroad. He's great. I mean, he's phenomenal. They haven't had much success as refugee claims from the United States until very recently. They're now covering the ground that the war in Iraq is illegal, right? I don't know what a legal war is, in my opinion, but I understand where they're coming from, right? It wasn't sanctioned by the UN. More countries than not said this is an illegal occupation, you know, and just the forefront there when they first went in. He's great. He's worked with me real well. He's since he has so much knowledge of the subject, I mean, he just blew me away with information and the fights that we can use and how we're going to attack this. And he's very informative. You know, he'll tell you everything you need to know. He'll go over everything with you to make sure you guys match, have the same stories. You know what I mean? And he's great. Yeah, he's real good.
Okay, and how did you find out all that information? So someone who did come across...
The War Resistor Support Campaign, when I arrived in Canada, gave me just a pamphlet.
Okay.
It told me basically all the steps I need to do, how I can apply for a work permit, my refugee claim, my driver's license, and all the basic necessities you need to come over here and start over, basically, right? And that's how I found out about Jeffrey Howes. He was listed. If you're in Toronto, you'll contact Jeffrey Howes. If you're in London, you'll contact Michael Robach, and it has those listed for you, so it's that helpful and easy.
Okay. And what is your legal status here right now in Canada?
I'm a pending refugee claimant. I go to the Immigration Refugee Board here in Toronto on September 17th, and that's when I'll find out if I'm allowed access or if there's a deportation order put out against me.
Okay.
So I'm David Heap. Of the London War Resistor Support Group.
Okay. What exactly is the London War Resistor Support Group?
So we formed about a year and a half ago with three broad areas of work. One is to materially support resistors who arrive in Canada, who've left ex-military personnel, who've left the U.S. military because they can't conscience the wars overseas, to educate the public about the resistors' cause and to lobby the Canadian government to let them stay.
Now, why is this issue so important to you? Why did you get involved in this?
I've been involved in the peace movement most of my life. When I was a kid in Toronto growing up, my parents had Vietnam resistors living in our home. So it's always been a natural for me, a given, that we had to do what we can. It's Canadian tradition to support those who oppose U.S. imperial wars. Back to 1812 and the Civil War and the Underground Railway bringing people to this country. So Canada's got a mixed record, but I think it's something we can be proud of as Canadians, that we've helped out those who oppose some of the worst of the imperial wars coming from the south. In London, we had a lot of people from different walks of life who were opposed to the Iraq invasion, and we coalesced around, rallying and protesting that. But when we realized that there were resistors coming here who were leaving the military, we realized that there's a really important concrete way that we could support the people who were in the front line or leaving the front line and needed our help. So it's a very concrete way to oppose war.
And what are some of the parallels you see with the current conflict and previous conflicts that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, it's the illegality of war and the fact that it's an unjustified. It's a war of aggression. It's not a war where any of the invading parties was in any way threatened, right? So that you can't dress it up as anything defensive. And it's a war which is deeply unpopular with the people who are supposed to be supporting it, right? I mean, it was sold to the U.S. public by way of lies, as previous aggression always is. I mean, you need to sell people some kind of propaganda about why you're going. But you scratch the surface and you discover there are no weapons of mass destruction and there was no aggression and there no connection with anybody who was even remotely connected with attacking the U.S. So you scratch any war of aggression and you discover that it's built on lies. So the war resistors movement across Canada has had support from the legal community. There's a number of lawyers who work with the individual resistors who make refugee claims. Right now, that's the only way most of them can stay in the country, is by claiming refugee status. Unfortunately, that means their cases get tried individually on whether they individually have a basis to fear persecution if they return to the U.S. What we're really looking for is a broader political statement that they all have the right to stay because they're all in the same position of refusing to serve in an illegal war. But it's being dealt with piecemeal, case by case right now. The worst of it is, just recently there's been one case of deportation. So Robin Long, a resistor who was in British Columbia, was deported to the U.S. And is currently in military prison. As has happened to other resistors who voluntarily returned to the U.S., some of them were promised discharges and discovered that they were doing time in a military prison, which is a hard labor prison.
Yeah.
And it means they come out with a felony conviction, the equivalent of a felony conviction in the States. So that's like a lifetime sentence of very limited opportunities for the rest of your life for those who return under those circumstances. So it's really important for us to work with the legal community and work with the broader community to say that the deportations are wrong. Parliament has voted in as majority. All the opposition parties voted a motion in Parliament to say that they should be allowed to stay and there should be no more deportations. And right now we're working towards a day of action in September across Canada to say let them stay and no more deportations.
Great. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was interesting. Bob Ray had an op-ed on the subject.
He did, in the Toronto Star, exactly. On July 11th, he came out saying why the U.S. war resistors deserve refuge in Canada, and he has actually made a case for why Canadians should be taking that type of a stance on this issue.
although there was, I believe, a non-binding vote in the House of Commons.
There was. I believe it was on, yeah, it was on June 3rd, I think it was, and the Liberal Party came out very strongly in terms of saying that we should be taking that type of response.
Although we should probably emphasize the non-binding aspect of it.
Definitely.
That said, you know, the Army, its job is to, you know, go overseas and shoot people, to, you know, defend the country or what have you. And I think a lot of people, there's an indignant article Toronto Star, like, well, I hope people now realize, you know, like, how can the Army, you know, they think the Army's about shooting people, it should be about, you know, digging out ditches and snow. Like, well, no, you know, there's a Peace Corps for that, you know, we need people, you know, to project national interests.
Well, Canada does have a different philosophy as well.
It's true. I mean,
we do use our Canadian forces, are used in a slightly different manner, and they are probably more utilized domestically in terms of those types of operations than they are overseas.
That's true. I guess Canadians kind of get a skewed perception of
what other countries do. Exactly.
Try to beat our swords into plowshares a little too early.
Or maybe not. Maybe we're visionaries for the global scene, and that's yet to be seen in any case.
I guess it will be seen.
Okay.
On another topic.
Yep.
This book, The Opportunity Maker, by Ari Kaplan.
His book is about how law students should, I guess, start thinking even early in their career, as early as in law school, about building networks, getting out there, and being independent in the sense that they can actually drop business to whatever firm they're with. And his rationale for doing that is that it'll create greater job satisfaction and also flexibility in terms of the type of work that you do.
I hear he has an entire chapter on blogging.
That's right. Chapter 10 is focused almost exclusively on blogging, and he says that it's an opportunity that a lot of law students are simply overlooking and not really getting the most out of. So we're very fortunate, I think, on our site, being the largest law school website in Canada, to be able to do what we're doing and have the type of presence that we do.
Oh, definitely. And I'm glad he spelled it blogging, not blogging.
There's still a lot of controversy over that, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's hear that interview.
Okay.
The book really tries to give people a practical sense of strategies that they can incorporate right now. So I practiced for nearly 9 years. With large law firms in New York City, and during that period published somewhere around 125 articles. And I would often take programs, you know, my firm would offer programs, they were very kind to offer lots of interesting programs, and they'd have experts come in, and those experts would always give me a whole list of things that I needed to do. But they would never, you know, they would just go on, and I would be up at night thinking about all this laundry list of things on top of everything else I had to do. They would never tell me how. It always frustrated me. So when I stopped practicing a couple of years ago, I created a program to teach lawyers how to get themselves published and then how to leverage that for business development. When I wrote this book, I wanted The Opportunity Maker to be the how. I wanted it to be a guide for people, to give them lots of different ideas that they can choose from and then incorporate into who they are and what they do best, right? Because some of us are more gregarious than others, and some of us are better at networking, and some of us are better at engaging with the community. So the book uses interviews with over 100 different people to try to help you, the reader, find out what it is that you can use that is best suited to who you are. So you talked about management skills, and you talked about public relations. So part of the book talks about studying the media. And when I say study the media, one of the experts said, hey, you should watch interviews with people by the media and to see what is it that they're interested in and what aren't they asking. But more importantly, I suggest that you reach out to a journalist and ask them to have coffee. And that's a theme, as you know, throughout the book, this idea of having coffee. You know, I'm a big, hey, let's get together kind of person rather than, hey, let's email back and forth. And when I lecture, I teach a summer associate program. And so when I speak to 2Ls at law firms, I ask them, how is it that you engage with people? And they'll inevitably these days, particularly this summer, say, oh, you know, Facebook or GChat or something that doesn't require any personal contact. And so the issue that the book talks about is not necessarily finding personal contact, although I'm a proponent of meeting face-to-face, but it's finding reasons, creating opportunities to interact. So what I mean by that is if you meet somebody and you learn that they've been in a job for 6 months, then you instantly know 6 months from now they will be celebrating a one-year anniversary. Uh-huh. And so you know 6 months from now it's not a holiday, it's not their birthday, but it's certainly an opportunity for you to reconnect. In the same way, if you meet somebody and you learn that they have an 11-month-old child, you know that they're going to be planning a first birthday, and in a month or so, you don't have to get the date right, but in a month or so, you could be thinking of them in a very genuine way and say, I bet you know, so-and-so, your child just had their first birthday. I hope it was as fun as it sounds, or whatever. It takes all of 12 seconds to do that, but that connection is really critical, and that's what the book really talks about.
One of the other things that struck me, you talk a lot about being a rainmaker, and talk about how you could be the best lawyer in the world, but if you can't create the business, then you're not going to be doing anything. And why is it important for students to start thinking about becoming a rainmaker now while they're in law school rather than once they start practicing?
It's a great question, and it's important because law students have a virtual get-out-of-jail-free card. You really do. You have a virtual, extensive creative license. You're not affiliated with any particular firm, although you may have received an offer or something at some point or work part-time, and you're not a member of any bar. So you can do creative things, not unlike your fantastic podcast. You know, it's the same idea. You know, if you were with a firm, for example, you'd probably want to get approval from the firm, and you'd want to make sure that people, you know, do certain things and that the image is in a certain way. But as a student, you can really just be a professional, but be a creative professional at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with rainmaking as it stands now is that it's seen as a partner issue. You know, it's an issue for someone that's practicing 8, 10, or more years. And people think there's some magic to it, that there are these people who are born rainmakers. They started out selling lemonade in front of their house. And then they started with a paper route. And before you knew it, they have $20 million book of business. But actually, I talk about the science of self-promotion in my book. And what I mean by that is that these are learned skills. They're honed over time. It's very much like investing. And so you always hear, if you invest, let's say, $100 a month into some historical market-bearing mutual fund, and you do that for the next 40 years, then at 65, you'll have $1 million. And so I'm not necessarily sure that's true because I have a number of decades to go, but I'm trusting that that'll be true. And so in the same way, you should trust that your business development potential and acumen will grow with time. And so why shouldn't you at 25 or in your 20s or whenever you end up going to law school start the process now? Your colleagues in other professional schools are doing it. Business school students and law school students view the world in completely different ways. And so think of it in terms of, well, I'm going to build relationships now. And now when it's so much easier, right? If you're going to try to connect with the general counsel of a company or the head partner at a firm, they're so much more likely to have a meeting with a law student, right? You're just sort of like, sweet law student. All you can offer is your enthusiasm and your interest in the law, and you're still really excited. And so these people are thinking, you know what? I was once a law student. I was once thinking of where I was going to go. I wasn't always the general counsel of some giant Fortune 500 company. And so they're thinking to themselves, I'm going to take a few minutes. Maybe I'll learn something. Maybe they'll talk to me about GChat and Facebook. But more importantly, maybe there's a way for me to give back. Maybe there's a way for me to nurture and encourage the next generation. People really feel that. And the people I spoke to were so generous with their time. I mean, I spoke to in-house counsel from large companies across the country, rainmakers, law students, business executives. I mean, lots of different people who were so really very kind just to speak to me and talk to me and provide some insight and guidance. In fact, I've re-interviewed some of them and posted 2 or 3 minute interviews on theopportunitymaker.com, which is where you can learn a little bit more about the book and some of the ideas that are embodied in it.
You talk about the difference between making contacts and making friends. And what is that distinction, and why is that distinction important?
It's important because we as a profession, you know, and I mean in the legal profession, there's a tremendous risk aversion built into the law for mm-hmm. whatever reason. And so we think of networking as this very distasteful experience. I'm now going to be lecturing at law schools. I speak at law firms across the United States generally, although my hope is to speak more in Canada. And I'm now speaking at law schools, and I spoke to someone today who said, you know, offering a program on networking is so critically important, but law students are sort of turned off. There's something distasteful about the idea of networking. It implies this idea of using people. But when you think about it in terms of making friends, not mm-hmm. contacts, you know, developing mm-hmm. relationships, not something that you're going to eventually use, then it completely transforms your perspective, and it allows you to create some sort of possibility that you can build some meaningful relationship, because that's what people who find success do. They build meaningful relationships, whether those relationships involve networking or mentoring or collaboration. They find ways to connect with people in a very positive and a very genuine way. And the authenticity of those relationships only comes when you can provide value to the other person. So people are always thinking, particularly students, are always thinking, how can someone help me? I need assistance. But my theory, and the book really talks about seeking guidance and insight, not assistance. Mm-hmm. Don't look for somebody to help you with something. Use the opportunity that you have now to look to somebody for guidance, to learn from them, to just listen to what they have to say, and listen to how they say it. I talk about storytelling in the book, and how listening to how someone tells their story is really critical for you to develop your own storytelling techniques, because that's what the great ones do. They come up with some story, and they weave their career into this story, and clients hire lawyers that are telling the same story that they are. They want to hear a story about success, and they want to hear a story about a struggle, and they want to hear a story about enthusiasm and excitement and problem solving. And so if in law school you can figure out how you can generate this level of excitement and enthusiasm, you're far, far ahead of your peers, which is why I interviewed a number of law students who were totally distinguished mm-hmm. from their peers. They had figured out that, and lots of them, I'll have to say, are bloggers. There's an amazing power in blogging in terms of the reach and in terms of the level of enjoyment that you find in what you're doing.
One of the things I did see throughout your book was that people should be thankful and express their thanks. So I would like to say thank you very much for your time here with us today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, one thing I found interesting in his book, as you mentioned, one of my favorite bloggers back in the day, Jeremy Blockman, who created this website called Anonymous Lawyer.
That's right.
Now, Jeremy was a law student, but he had this anonymous blog that was pretending to be the blog of his partner at a big law firm in California. And it was huge. People were speculating on who the real author was, and no one really thought that it was a student. Some people thought it might be a summer student, just because he focused a lot on summer students. He said he was a partner that was responsible for, you know, liaising with students, because some people still thought it focused a little too much on students. But it was a very funny blog, very cynical, very dark, and it actually got turned into a book. So, you know, this, I would get this book, The Opportunity Maker, but if you're in the bookstore, also pick up Anonymous Lawyer. It's very funny. And
I think we're going to wrap up now. And we're going to try some different closing music today as well from another war resister, someone from the Vietnam War era, who came to Canada and settled here and stayed here. So
great. Let's listen to that.